From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The recent federal tax reform law has grabbed plenty of headlines. But a representative from the group Americans for Tax Reform joins us to tout other recent wins in the fight for better tax policy. Tighter security could be on the way for North Carolina's legislative complex. You learn details, including the possibility of metal detectors at the state legislative building. U.S. senators recently debated the nomination of a Raleigh attorney to become a new federal district court judge. You'll hear highlights from their comments for and against him. And we'll explain how solar energy projects are pitting neighbor against neighbor in some North Carolina communities. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
With news that Amazon has now selected Raleigh as a top 20 finalist for its second headquarters, speculation has begun about exactly what kind of package the city, or perhaps the region, may offer to the retailer in order to lure a reported 50,000 jobs that would be part of the deal. And that, of course, leads to questions about just how much money taxpayers might be on the hook for. Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson is following the story. He's here to talk about it. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, is it Raleigh that's a finalist, or is it the Triangle? Is it the state?
It's the Research Triangle area in general in Raleigh. I guess a city had to list it, had to be listed as the host, but property could be located in the RTP. It could be located in Durham. It could be located pretty much anywhere in the region. But Raleigh was the focus, and it's just, I think, a paperwork issue as much as anything.
It was interesting as well that the folks in Durham apparently called to make sure that
right.
they were included since
yeah.
they don't like not being included when people talk about the Triangle.
Right.
Okay, so it looks like several potential sites. Well, first of all, what does Amazon want? What do we know about the RFP, so to speak?
Well, what they're looking for is they're looking for a site that – or at least a region that has plenty of tech workers affordable housing, a growing economy, a good wage base, nice quality of life features and things like that. One of the criteria was they were talking about public transit, which the Triangle cannot provide the sort of rail transit that some other places can. That clearly was not enough to disqualify Raleigh. And in fact, Charlotte didn't get on the list, and Charlotte actually does have rail transit. So that may say that I think probably if you're talking about a difference between the commute, let's say, in Silicon Valley or the Seattle area or something like that versus the normal commute here in the Triangle area, then I think mass transit's not that big of a deal because the typical rush hours are much different in those places.
You know, we mentioned Durham and the little bit of rivalry there between the cities. I believe it was the Charlotte Observer that also the paper wrote a little piece saying, gee, you know, we're out of it, but we may have to actually kind of support our compadres over
yeah.
in the Triangle area.
Right.
So it sounds like for those who believe that this is a really good idea, and certainly who wouldn't want more jobs, but where the discussion and the debate comes in is how you go about it,
yeah.
what the package might be. So
right.
what does this mean in terms of incentives? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, they're going to be looking for some sort of giveaways. They're going to be looking for some sort of corporate tax breaks, some sort of deferral or forgiveness of property taxes. They're going to be looking for something possibly in the way of forgiveness of local taxes, basically to workers or something like that. They may be looking for something, who knows, maybe free tuition to college for all of their, who knows what sorts of things they'll be looking for in an incentives package. And the thing that's interesting is that Governor Roy Cooper has already come out and said, yeah, we're going to be throwing some money at you, but don't expect too much.
Interesting that North Carolina recently lost the opportunity to be home to an auto manufacturing plant. That went to the state of Alabama, I believe it was. And the comparison of the packages there, North Carolina had actually offered about $1.5 billion in incentives. Alabama, much less. So it's not always what you offer them.
That's right. Because in Alabama's case, the situation was that they already had automobile manufacturers there. And so the supply chains of all the parts and various equipment and things like that were already established. So it wasn't a matter of having to invent a source of suppliers for the manufacturing facility. It was already there. It was just a matter of expanding it. So North Carolina had to sort of, you know, sweeten the pot a little bit more to say, well, we may not have it now, but if we throw enough money at your way, then we'll attract all these other folks to come in and it'll make the difference. The governor said that Amazon's not, shouldn't expect $1.5 billion. It's that was an offer for an auto plant, not for a high-tech corporate headquarters.
Now, I know the Carolina Journal is going to be reporting going forward on all sorts of different angles to this story, one of them being exactly what do you do if you're a region or a state, and you certainly would want jobs, more jobs coming to your area. But it's a real policy debate, isn't it, Rick, over what you do, what you offer, how much is enough, how much is too much, and should you get involved in what some people, including one of the analysts here at the Locke Foundation, has deemed as crony capitalism?
Right. That's the problem with this situation is that what North Carolina offers and other places don't is a lower corporate tax environment. We've got one of the lowest corporate tax rates in the country for states that use corporate income tax. And also, we don't really offer an awful lot of carve-outs and exceptions, generally speaking. So our climate is going to be based on the fact that we do have the major technology-oriented research universities here in the Triangle area. We do have other high-tech corporate headquarters or corporate presences here like Citrix and Red Hat and the like, and that we do have the attractiveness of the area in general, the fact that we do have a very well-educated workforce. We have an awful large influx of people from the outside, many of whom have a lot of training and skills. And even so, much like a place like Nashville or Austin, for instance, the housing prices here are relatively low compared to an awful lot of other tech hubs like Boston or Silicon Valley or something like that.
And you mentioned some of those other cities. Some of the competitors that we are facing, you've got the major cities, Los Angeles, right, and New York, and you've got the traditional competitors for North Carolina for many industries such as Austin and Boston. So it appears that the Amazon people have chosen a wide range of cities, regions to be considered the top 20.
Right.
Do you think they are finding something in particular about each of those areas, or are they just wanting people to kind of guess and think everybody really has a shot?
Well, it certainly increases the price of playing poker when that's the case. If you've got 20
right.
people at the table rather than, let's say, three.
Right.
And so that means that I'm certain that any of these 20 places would be appropriate. I mean, I'm sure that everyone meets at least a minimal standard of what Amazon's looking for. The question then is, what are the trade-offs involved in picking one place over another? I think I would find Los Angeles, for instance, to be the least likely place to get that, simply because the state of California is now talking about asking businesses to return some of their federal tax cut money to the state to help the state pay off its budget deficit. So I'm thinking if you're looking to locate a headquarters there, the first thing you say is, well, you know, there's certain tax benefits you just got, but we're taking them away from you. Or we're asking you to give back for the good of the state. So, I mean, there are certain things that state policymakers do that sort of that sour the pot, not sweeten it. But I think what we'll find out here is that North Carolina will be an attractive location because of our tax and regulatory environment. However, if we start throwing too much money at the project, or we start offering too many promises, then there's a very good chance that here, as John Sanders here at the Locke Foundation has said, that there are economists who say you'll actually lose money on the deal, that you will not get, if you offer forgiveness for income tax payments, for instance, from either the business or from the employees, well, then therefore you're really not generating much money, but you are generating more traffic. You're increasing housing prices. You're doing all sorts of other things to make the quality of life a little bit lower.
And readers of Carolina Journal and listeners to Carolina Journal Radio may recall in the past that there have been an instance or two in our state where You give out a big package, and then they don't come through with the jobs.
That's right.
So it's a cautionary tale for policymakers, whether it's at the city of Raleigh or if the state gets involved or whatever, to be extremely careful.
That's correct.
We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. And, of course, you can read the daily news update at carolinajournal.com. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Governments across the country have inserted themselves into people's lives with actions such as taxing soda and taxing or even banning plastic bags. But those efforts have suffered some recent setbacks. Joining us to discuss the latest developments is Patrick Gleason, Director of State Affairs for the group Americans for Tax Reform. Welcome back to the program, Patrick.
So great to be back, Mitch.
Working for a group called Americans for Tax Reform, it has to be frustrating when you see governments across the country targeting things like this, like soda or like plastic bags or other things where it's not a broad-based general tax, but something that's really specific and not really something that helps boost the economy.
Yeah, soda tax is a great example of a type of tax that we would oppose, and it's basically what we'd see, a great example of the antithesis of sound pro-growth tax policy. It's targeted, it discriminates against one industries over the other, and also it's intended to influence behavior. And we think, you know, the best approach at Americans for Tax Reform to tax policy is you want low rates, broad basis, but the tax code is meant to raise the amount of revenue for government. It's not to influence behaviors, and that is what the soda taxes at least have been sold as. But in addition to influencing behavior, oftentimes in most cases with soda taxes, the ultimate impetus behind these is really a cash grab to raise revenue. And so we've seen an uptick in that. Actually, that's an area where ATR typically focuses on. We work at the federal level, you know, working on tax reform at the state level and state capitals across the country. But soda tax is an example of an issue that's really caused us to focus more and more over the years at the local and municipal level, because as state legislatures have been taken over by more taxpayer-friendly compositions, more taxpayer-friendly majorities, a lot of the bad ideas have started to be pushed down to the local level. So we've seen this in a lot of big cities, and soda taxes have been popping up in a lot of places lately.
You mentioned big cities. This was something that was really championed by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and really took off after he made it one of his causes. But you also saw some recent good news on this front, didn't you?
Yeah. So surprisingly good news on this front after losing some battles in recent years, seeing the imposition of a soda tax in Philadelphia last year, a number of cities in the Bay Area, Berkeley, San Francisco, and a few other Bay Area cities, and then Boulder, Colorado. This year, the tide has turned a bit on the soda tax war and the soda tax debate. Really good news, surprising good news from Cook County, Illinois, which is the home of Chicago. And Cook County, Cook County Commission approved late last year a soda tax, a penny per ounce soda tax. And that went into effect this summer. And it was only in effect for 2 months, and already the backlash against it from the community, from business owners, was so strong that Cook County, I mean, you could not find a more tax and spend friendly jurisdiction than Chicago, Cook County. They even backed down. The Cook County Commission, by a vote of 15-2, voted to repeal the Cook County soda tax. Great news. It's off the books, and it'll be off the books in December. And that was surprising there, and that comes on the heels of a repeal of another soda tax in Wisconsin. It wasn't a soda tax designed like the Cook County and other ones we've seen, like Philly, but it was an old relic that had been on the books. If you sell soda, if you're a retailer, you had to pay this special little fee. So they got that. It was an arcane charge that was on the books, but technically a soda tax nonetheless. So that was taken off the books. So two really good bits of news. And this is Mayor Michael Bloomberg, big proponent. He's been spending his wealth around the country pushing these. He did in Philly. He did in Cook County. And then during the recent repeal effort, he was spending millions on an ad campaign to fight that. And with the victory in repealing that regressive tax, soda tax in Cook County, I just think it goes to show you, even when the money is on the other side, if you are right on the issue and you have a sound argument, you can win. And so we saw that in Cook County. That on top of Wisconsin, on top of earlier this year, Santa Fe was they put it on the ballot. This is a left-leaning city that went overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton in last year's presidential election. They overwhelmingly rejected it in Santa Fe earlier this spring. So Santa Fe, then Cook County, a series of defeats for Michael Bloomberg and the rest of his nanny state soda tax proponent crew.
That is the voice of Patrick Gleason, who is Director of State Affairs for Americans for Tax Reform. Let's switch gears a little bit. Another thing that has attracted attention either through taxation or even banning is the idea of plastic bags, something that anyone who's gone to North Carolina's Outer Banks has known about. You also say there's been some good news on taxes of plastic bags, too.
Yeah, so plastic bag bans and taxes, that's another issue that we've been working on, fighting against at the state and local level. And it actually is similar to soda taxes, and soda taxes are sold as a way to improve health and combat obesity. And plastic bag bans or taxes either are sold as a way to improve the environment, reduce pollution. Soda taxes do not reduce obesity. They do not improve health, and plastic bag bans and taxes do not improve the environment. They don't reduce litter. So that's a common theme. And as with soda taxes, we've seen in the recent backlash against those and realization that they're just cash grabs and don't improve health. Similarly, on a similar track, we've seen a greater recognition with plastic bag bans and taxes lately. The recognizing that these don't improve the environment, they don't reduce litter, they're just cash grabs that make people feel good. And
the
so
ones who impose them,
the ones
at
who
least.
The people who impose them, they feel great, they feel very good about themselves, but they hurt. They hurt lower income, like soda taxes. Bag taxes are regressive. Bag bans disproportionately inconvenience lower income households, people who take public transportation, not the people who have a large Audi station wagon full of reusable bags. And their life is good. Bumper sticker in their back of their car. You know, it's easy for them to cope with that. Not so much someone taking public transportation. So, like we've seen with soda taxes, there has been a tide turning and a backlash against them. So, North Carolina recently was the center of that debate, and as you mentioned, the Outer Banks targeted bag ban. The bag prohibition was repealed smartly by the legislature. This was a relic of the previous regime that used to control the state prior to 2010. And point of fact, the bag ban and bag bans, there's no evidence that they do anything to reduce litter. That was documented with studies in this state, but also, you know, there's been examples from other states. Now, San Francisco was the first jurisdiction to impose a bag ban similar to what eventually came on the books here for the Outer Banks. Thankfully, now it's off the books. But San Francisco, first city to move forward with it, 2007, the year after. If we examined litter audits for the year before the bag ban went into effect and the year after, and you will question your career line when you find yourself reading litter audits and pouring through them. But looking at the litter audits before and after, we found that not only did bags, and this is the case nationwide, not only do plastic bags comprise a minuscule share of total litter, but the year after the ban was in effect, the share of litter that was comprised of bags was actually greater. So if your goal is to get at litter and mitigate litter, bags are not a good target, and they've been shown to be even effective at doing that. So we've seen that. So that's why we think it was good policy. And so, you know, if of all places where you probably need – you could reuse plastic bags – the beach is one, and that's the thing that the nanny status who think plastic bags are the scourge of the world. That's the thing they miss is they call them single use plastic bags, but that's really incorrect because plastic bags, by and large, are frequently reused for many things. Minneapolis City Council, which is ideologically as far on the opposite side of the spectrum as you can get from the North Carolina General Assembly. Left-leaning Minneapolis City Council, they were considering a bag tax in this case. And like soda taxes are regressive, would disproportionately harm the poor. We were fully expecting that to pass. And then surprisingly, after hearing a lot of pressure from the community – They backed down. It was similar to the arguments we hear, the public backlash we saw to soda taxes in Chicago. In Minneapolis, people said, we don't want this regressive tax. It's going to harm lower-income households disproportionately, and it's not going to improve the environment. These are positive developments. They are turns in the change of course, turns in the tide that we've been seeing in these two fights, battles nationwide against nanny state taxes that make people feel good but don't really do much good other than drain the bank accounts of families.
Patrick Gleason, he is the Director of State Affairs for Americans for Tax Reform. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Increased security could be on the way for the North Carolina General Assembly. Democratic State Representative Garland Pierce recently asked Legislative Police Chief Martin Brock about metal detectors.
How far are we away from metal detectors is coming into our building? I noticed the people's building is that would be probably hard, but is that a conversation? Is that something that being had?
Absolutely, Representative. We are constantly having those conversations. We are looking at plans and procedures to put that in place.
In the day-to-day operation, will that really hinder people coming in and out? I mean, we want safety, but I look at the number of people coming in, school students, just people all the time. So what do you see as the downside as operating this building if you had to have metal detectors and slowing the traffic coming in and out of the buildings?
I fully agree that this is the people's building, and we want everyone to have access, and I fully believe that the public should be able to come and watch legislators enact legislation. However, I do think that we can do it in a reasonable way that balances safety and security, as other states have done. I am the General Assembly Police Chief. I will do my best to enact any procedures and programs that the Commission and the legislators pass.
Republican Representative Larry Pittman passed along ideas from an outside security expert.
He was making some suggestions along the lines of having metal detectors, and also he said something about maybe having an armed guard at the door, you know, and some other things. So I'm glad to hear that y'all considering some things. I, too, believe that this is the people's facility, and they need to be able to get into it, but we do need to be safe. Of course, I have advocated allowing members and staff to be armed, and I still advocate that.
Guns for legislators? Senator Ronald Braben asked Police Chief Brock about the idea.
What's your personal feeling, if you will, on concealed carry for members and for staff in as we go about our duties, given that we get the training and all of that?
I have a lot of concerns when any time deadly weapons or serious weapons is being discussed. I can tell you that General Assembly Police Department trains frequently in the use of firearms and the use of defensive tactics and response. There are a lot of identification or misidentification issues that come up, the amount of training, the background of each individual. I also believe in enforcing the law. So whatever legislation is passed, I will do my best to enforce it.
That's General Assembly Police Chief Martin Brock responding to questions about security at the state legislative building in Raleigh. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A Raleigh attorney recently generated some buzz on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee debated President Trump's nomination of Thomas Farr of Raleigh to serve as the new U.S. District Court judge. Democrats such as Dianne Feinstein of California lined up against Farr.
The Eastern District of North Carolina has a population that is roughly 27% African American. Yet this district has never had an African American federal district court judge. The history of this vacancy makes it all the more troubling that Mr. Farr has a long record fighting on behalf of racially gerrymandered voting districts that dilute the voting power of African American voters.
Other Democratic senators added to the chorus of complaints about Farr.
Could this administration have picked an individual who is more hostile to the rights of minorities than this man? It is hard to imagine.
He has been described by the NAACP as a product of the white supremacist machine.
Perhaps someone who is the most objectionable judicial nominee we've seen in this past year.
I think Thomas Farr is probably the worst of the litter here in terms of being able to be someone who, African-American voter, seeking to vindicate his or her rights under the Voting Rights Act, could credibly be asked to believe will get a fair hearing from this judge, particularly on voting rights issues, when there is so much evidence that we have shown that he was actually involved in voter intimidation tactics back in the Helms campaign, and that he has not been forthcoming with this committee in describing his action.
Senator Kamala Harris added more detail to the Democrats' accusations.
In 1990, Senator Jesse Helms was running for re-election. The Helms campaign infamously sent out the postcards which have been mentioned to 125,000 black voters, stating they could be prosecuted and imprisoned for up to 5 years if they voted in a precinct they had lived in for fewer than 30 days. The Justice Department under President George H.W. Bush described these actions as, quote, intended to intimidate thousands of African-American residents and discourage them from voting in the 1990 United States Senate election. One of those Helms campaign lawyers was Thomas Farr.
North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis responded to the Democrats' complaints.
First, I want to talk a little bit about history, and I wasn't thinking about it until after I heard Senator Leahy speak about the blue slip policy. And Senator Feinstein talked about the nominations for the Eastern District during the Obama administration. But I think to complete the history, we also have to recognize that Tom Farr was put forth in 2006 and again in 2007. Now, to be fair, the blue slip policy was honored, but there was never a hearing in this committee, which seems to me to be a different means to the same ends in terms of preventing judges from going forward. I also have to talk a little bit about the characterizations of Mr. Farr and his participation in the Helms campaign. Number one, what was done was despicable. You know, quite honestly, anyone who had anything to do with the production of the mailer shouldn't really have a job in political life today, as far as I'm concerned. And I happen to know some of those people. But the fact of the matter is, Tom Farr, as it was said in this committee just a few minutes ago, was campaign counsel. He was never campaign counsel. And they were right. The Bush administration was right to bring a case against the Helms campaign. The fact of the matter is, Tom Farr was never named as a defendant. In fact, the whole narrative, no matter how many times you say it, I don't believe it to be true, and it's been said many times today, is based on the comments and the single source for a liberal media outlet that was from Gerald Hebert. This is somebody who had to recant his testimony, as people accurately report it, before this committee, before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1986. He recanted his testimony. What I find remarkable, after he recanted his testimony, he still proudly authored an article that said, "My testimony about Jeff Sessions kept him from being a judge." Now, this is also somebody who in the Department of Justice brought a frivolous lawsuit dealing with voting rights in Alabama that resulted in sanctions from a judge that was appointed by Jimmy Carter. So I don't necessarily think that single source serves as a basis for somebody who would come before this committee who would testify and tell the truth. Tom Farr is that person.
After rebutting dubious claims about Thomas Farr's history, North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis turned to Farr's qualifications to serve as a U.S. District Court judge.
Now let's just talk about qualifications. The gold standard for well-qualified, unanimous well-qualified. Tom Farr's gotten it twice. That suggests to me that if this was the ABA on the Judiciary Committee, they'd be voting them out by voice vote. Look, I get that we have differences in our political ideologies, but I think absolutely destroying a good man's reputation is inappropriate. He answered questions honestly. He responded in the letter to my satisfaction. He has people who were on the committee that said if we had consulted with Tom Farr, we'd have never sent out that mailer. They're convinced of that because he's a fair man. He's been judged unanimously well-qualified twice. And for the people who look at Tom Farr through the eyes of an attorney, I think that they would see that he's going to be a fantastic judge. He's going to be a fair judge, and he shouldn't be judged on the basis of false claims made by Mr. Hebert, whose own credibility is on the line. I won't use this word like Senator Leahy. I wouldn't use this word, but a synonym for misleading is bamboozling. He bamboozled, apparently, a Senate committee, and now we're going to use Helms' gospel as the only source for something he had no direct involvement in back in the Helms campaign. So I believe that Tom Farr is going to make a good judge, a great judge. I also know that Tom Farr has broad-based support from across the ideological spectrum because he's a good man. He's built great relationships. He's been mentors to people that couldn't be further away from him ideologically. and I'm going to proudly support his nomination, and I hope my colleagues will as well.
Republican Committee Chairman Charles Grassley also spoke in Farr's favor.
I guess people use ABA ratings when they want to, and when they want to ignore them, they ignore them. But this person has gone through two of them in the Bush administration and then in this administration and received well-qualified. The last time, I guess, was well-qualified with one abstention. But also to take into consideration that one of the points that the ABA looks at, and I don't know whether these are exact words they use, but it's a basis that they make a judgment on, a commitment to equal rights.
Grassley batted back Democrats' request for a second hearing on Farr's nomination.
There have been numerous opportunities for all committee members to question Mr. Farr, and I'm sorry to say that I disagree with the need for a second hearing because I think he has been candid and truthful. And I think particularly Senator Tillis has laid out a stronger point than I can even make for his confirmation.
Grassley's committee approved the nomination. Thomas Farr of Raleigh has been nominated four times since 2006 to serve in this same position as U.S. District Court Judge for Eastern North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Tensions and conflicts have begun to occur in some rural parts of North Carolina as solar power developers pay farmers to lease their land for use as solar farms rather than traditional crop farms. Carolina Journal Associate Editor Dan Way has been delving into this angle of North Carolina's solar power industry. He reported on it recently for CarolinaJournal.com. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna. Always glad to be here.
Your story says that flat farmland is what the solar power developers are looking for. And in North Carolina, we've got a lot of that.
Well, we do. And in North Carolina right now is the number two state in the nation for the amount of installed solar capacity, behind only California. So we have an explosive growth of solar facilities, and they do one of the complaints from the agricultural community is that they're taking up this good, viable farmland, but it's not always on the flat farmland, and that creates some of the tension with local communities because there are concerns about environmental issues with putting these on sloping hills with runoff and, you know, pesticide use and other concerns.
Dan, it was pretty interesting, the people that you reported on in Iredell County who are involved right now in this conflict. And really, it seems to boil down to two different points of view that has these neighbors pitted against neighbors, as you put it in your story. One is, hey, it's my property. If I want to lease it to a solar power developer and they want to put solar cells on it, well, that's my right to do that. The other is, look, you are fundamentally changing not just your property and how things look and feel in our community, but you're impacting me, your neighbor, as well. And both seem pretty compelling.
They are both property rights issues to some degree, but they're not uncommon when it comes to land use legal issues. So whether this would be a gravel pit, a strip mall, an adult bookstore, we see these kinds of legal tensions play out all over the place. It's just that this now is very much a growth industry, and so people who have land, and they can lease it for a decent price to a solar developer, want to be able to use their land the way they see fit.
And I didn't realize this, but in your story you said that many farmers lease more land than they actually farm themselves.
Right. And the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service tells us that most farmers today don't own enough land to produce what they're selling. So they're dependent very much on neighboring landowners to lease their fields. And so, again, this creates a competitive situation where if the landowners who are leasing farms land to you now can make a better price by putting a solar farm on there, that's the direction they're probably going to go. So farmers would have to increase the amount of rent that they would pay in order to keep the farmland.
It is such an interesting look at tensions because, as you said, this may be a new venue, a new vehicle that's creating the disagreements in the community, but could easily be a fence in past years. But now it is these much larger solar farms. Describe one to us. What are we talking about here?
Well, if you've ever been out to one of these sites, you will see a gigantic sprawl, an actual sea of metal and glass that are comprising these solar panels. And in some places, they can go on almost as far as your eye vision can go, out to the tree lines in the distance or whatever. So they're really mammoth, but they range in size. Some of them are smaller. But the big ones, such as this one, really have the community in uproar because it's going to affect a large landmass.
And this is a company that's gone into Iredell County in this case.
This is Cypress Creek Renewables. They have a number of projects around the state. They have offices in Asheville and Durham. They're California-based. They're one of the biggest solar developers in the country.
So you have several landowners that are profiled in your story. And again, folks can read this at carolinajournal.com. Tell us about the stories of what's happening there.
Yeah, now these stories, this profile, you could find the same situation, the same scenario, the same people, only the names would change in other counties around the state. I focused on this one because it was still in the initial stages of getting a special use permit to put this project in. So I went around and talked to the folks, the people who live in the neighborhood, understand that they're going to have this giant eyesore there. And some folks move out into the country because they want that atmosphere. They want that quiet charm. And not that these will produce any noise once the construction is completed, but it alters the harmony is one of the things that they look at, the harmony of the community. Is it in harmony with the community?
Because if you're thinking, gee, I want to live in a more rural part of the state, I want a quiet community, whether I'm, raising a family in my prime earning years, farming, or whether I'm retiring, you don't think of giant solar farm as something that could potentially be your neighbor, but you're going to have to start thinking that now.
Right. And in this particular case, there's a retired heart surgeon, Keith Gatland, who is opposed to the project. He has his property in conservation easement. He wants to conserve his property for the wildlife. He and his wife are retired. They have a small animal menagerie, a little horse farm there. And they enjoy walking through the woods and seeing the little critters, the deer and the dove flying about. And they're concerned that once this massive complex gets put in there, that all the animals who've relied on that habitat are not going to be able to thrive and survive anymore. So it's going to affect the ability of, some of the woodland creatures to stay in that area.
So what's their recourse? Is there any recourse if someone disagrees with this and they know that their neighbor across the way is getting ready to sign one of these leases?
There is. One of the problems with land use issues as solar has developed is that most people look at this as a political issue. They're going to go down to their local government and say, hey, we don't want this and you need to stop it. But it's really not that easy. It's actually a quasi-judicial hearing at the local government level where they take testimony. There are certain criteria that have to be met in order to approve or disapprove or reject an application. And so what's happened up to this point is that most local communities are caught unawares of just how specific and technical these arguments are. The solar companies come in, they have a team of professional experts, lawyers who've done this before, they have a playbook to work from. The folks who are fighting against it often don't know what they're even in store for. So they can win at the local level. If the local government rejects the special use permit, The person, the developer, then can appeal that to Superior Court. And there have been a number of cases where the local governments have been upheld at the Superior Court level. But there have been a string of cases now where once it's appealed to the Court of Appeals, it gets overturned. And so there are some counties now that are trying to determine what they're going to do in response to that, whether they're going to try to continue to fight it or just let it go. But basically the courts have the courts are looking at these things as very fact-based evidence. And there's a certain specific legal definition of the kinds of evidence they can look at. And oftentimes they're saying the local folks just didn't meet that bar.
So, Dan, let's say that one of these farms goes in, one of these solar farms. How long is it there for?
Well, that's a big unknown, and that is part of the contention in these legal proceedings. The developers might say a 20-year lease or 30-year lease, some say 40 years, but we don't really
have any. A generation is what you're talking about here. So this is a long-term deal.
And we don't have any that old yet, so we don't know if they last that long.
Well, and that's a good question because some people say, and you've reported on concerns about environmental impact. What happens when the lease is over? Do they remove the panels or what happens to the land? What condition is it in?
Well, that's a big question. Some places have a decommissioning plan. Some local ordinances require a decommissioning plan. But there's a big question looming where these things will be disposed of. The developers will say there's a recycling market. Some say no.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Donna Martinez. Please join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.